This conversation between Rick Mundy and Walter Langford is being taped in the Adams Mark Hotel in St. Louis on May 9th, 1989. I see you're born in New Jersey, Bayonne, New Jersey.
No, I was born in Batesville, Arkansas.
No, I'm sorry.
Batesville, Arkansas. Yeah,
right.
I was born there, then my family moved to California when I was about a year old. So I
tell me when you got started in baseball.
It's funny, the other day I was talking to somebody about it. They said, you know, you recall? And I said, yeah, I remember when I was 8 1/2 years old. Mm-hmm. They brought around to the elementary school I was going to.
Mm-hmm.
The sign-up sheets for Little League. And one of the things that I wish had taken place, I wish my grandfather had been able to see me play Major League Baseball, because as a youngster growing up, my family was very close, and he was a big baseball fan. He passed away when I was in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And never really saw me play, but I remember coming home from my first Little League game, and my grandfather telling everybody, he says, well, Rick almost hit a home run. I said, really? Where did he hit it? He says, well, he didn't, but if he would have hit the ball, it would have been a home run.
That's loyalty. And grandfatherly love.
Yeah.
And what part of California were you living in then?
Santa Monica.
Oh, yeah.
Southern California.
And you went from high school to Arizona State?
Went there, and surprisingly enough, I went there after being scouted by a few ball clubs, because that was before the draft was put mm-hmm. into effect.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, played for a Dodger rookie team that was coached by the late Kenny Myers, who was with the Dodgers as a batting instructor and a scout, and Tom Lasorda. Is that they managed that ball club, man.
Uh-huh.
There were tryouts. I remember the first time I ever saw Tom Lasorda. He was a left-handed catcher during the tryouts.
Yeah.
He was catching batting practice. Then I looked up 10 minutes later, he's throwing.
Left-handed pitcher.
He's throwing batting practice. Then I looked up, he's working with the outfielders, and he's working with the infielders,
mm-hmm.
and he's working with the pitchers. And I said, who is this guy? Who is this guy? But I did not sign. As a matter of fact, Tommy had tried to sign me as a scout out of high school, out of Santa Monica High. And my mother and my family, for that matter, grew up in Los Angeles, so you know, her favorite two players were Don Drysdale and Sandy Koufax.
Figures.
And she had asked Tom Lasorda if he could get an autographed picture of her two favorite players, and he got those. As a matter of fact, my mother still has those. And came very close to signing out of high school with the Dodgers and the Pirates and the White Sox, and the Yankees too were in there signing. And the Pittsburgh Pirates finally came down. We were not going to sign. My mother said at the time, when I was 17 years old, and said, you know, you can have him. She told Tommy, she said, Tommy, you can have him after he goes to at least 2 years of college. He'll be 19 years old then, but right now he's not really ready. And I wasn't. So it was through the Pittsburgh Pirates, actually, that they contacted Bobby Winkles, the coach at Arizona State University. And that's how I went to Arizona State, was really through the Pittsburgh Pirate organization.
Now, if I remember rightly, either they were classmates of yours at Arizona State or played there, I think at the same time, people like Sal Bando and Reggie
Jackson. Sal Bando, Duffy Dyer, and I played on the same team.
Yeah.
Jackson was a year behind us.
Uh-huh.
But I think there were about six or seven guys off that 1965 collegiate championship team that I think signed professionally.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe there were at least four that made it to major leagues.
Yeah. Great. Now, where'd you go in the minors?
I signed in 65. As a matter of fact, we were playing in the College World Series when the draft came up. And just to prove to everybody that I should have been the number one draft choice, I struck out four times that night. And everybody was saying, you know, forget the guy that was drafted number one. He says, they should have signed the guy that struck him out four times. But we were playing in the College World Series. We wound up beating Ohio State in the final game to win the championship.
Mm-hmm.
And right after this, the baseball season was over, is that Sal Bando and I joined the Major League Ball Club for about 2 weeks and traveled with them
In 65?
Yes,
in 65. You didn't get into a game, but you traveled with them.
We traveled with them and worked out with them, and then we played an exhibition game with the big league club against their double-A ball club. And then after that, we went to different areas. I went to Lewiston, Idaho in the Northwest League and finished up the season there the following year after getting out of the Marine Corps Reserves, which I immediately after that season at the end of 65. Dave Duncan, who was a catcher and now the pitching coach of the Oakland A's, he and I and Bob Watson, who is now assistant to the general manager of the Houston Astros, team. All three of us were in Marine Corps boot camp together at, in San Diego. So that following year, joined the ball club and played in Mobile, Alabama in double-A ball. And at the end of the season, Bando and I were called up to the big leagues.
We got up went and got in 17 games in 66. Al Dark was the manager.
Yeah.
And he still was the manager at the start of the next season.
Yeah, he was the manager at the start of the next season, and then during the season he was fired and Luke Kaplan took over in Washington, D.C.
Right. And in 67, people like Catfish and Blue Moon Odom and Campaneris and Bando and yourself and Reggie and Rudy all appeared briefly, at least.
But one time or another, and you could see, I mean, you could see at the end of 66 and 67 and see the people that they had in the minor leagues. I mean, in double-A ball, we had Jim Nash, Blue Moon Odom. I think Chuck Dobson was there for a while. It was Bando, myself, Rene Latchman. I mean, there were a lot of guys that were very young players.
Who would you say was responsible for scouting and signing all those guys, Finley or one of his scouts?
No, Finley, Charlie probably took credit for it, but it was his scouts.
By the end of his tenure there, he practically had no scouts even, as I understand things.
Well, he had very few scouts and he had very few people that were ready to throw a parade in his favor.
Honor,
certainly, some people in Kansas City were not thrilled with losing a ball game, a ball club. Ball I think that they were thrilled to see Charlie leave.
That's right. Good old Charlie. He's got his pluses. He did a few things for baseball, but he created a hell of a lot of strife and ill feeling too.
Charlie was not one of my favorite people. Or
I don't think anyone I've talked to who was close to Charlie would say that. Jack McKeon tells some good ones.
Oh yeah.
Now in '68 you were over in Oakland and Bob Kennedy was the manager for that one year, and Raleigh Fingers joined the team. As I go along and mention names, if you think of anything special you want to say about any of these guys or any anecdotes that come to mind when their names are mentioned, break right in, please. You didn't. You finished sixth that year, and then in 69 you had Hank Bauer as manager for a time, and John McNamara finished.
Which McNamara I had played for in double-A ball in Mobile, Alabama. And to this day is a very good friend.
Seems like an awfully nice man.
Well, you know, I think if you look back in life, and not just because of thinking you're unique because you play baseball, I think there are always people that you look at and you respect more than just either because of professional association or just happening to run into them. And Jonathan McNamara is one of those people, and I put in the same category as a Bobby Winkles with Arizona State. Is it people that really and genuinely had something that to this day are qualities that if I have them, it's responsible in part due to those two individuals that are class human beings that fortunately for me, I happened to run across them at a very early age.
Makes a difference.
Yeah.
Bobby's still a coach somewhere, isn't he?
Matter of fact, he's gone this year. He's still with the Expos, but he's gone to the broadcast booth.
Follow that line.
So we'll see him on this road trip, as a matter of fact.
Well, that year you 69, you made a move up to second place in the American League West behind Minnesota. And Tennis joined you, and Blue had his first appearance, but he wasn't to make his big...
There were a couple of youngsters that, that came up.
Green was
69, Vida Blue came up, and then in the early 70s, I don't remember if it was 70 or 71, there was another guy that came up. Called him Teddy Bear or something like that. The big kid that never really did that much, but Vida Blue came up and people kept saying, well, you know, he just got the one pitch and he throws a breaking ball a little bit here and there. We had, you know, had a pitching staff. It was much nicer to play behind him than have to go to the plate and face him.
That I can believe. Well, in 70, McNamara was in charge completely, and you were second to Minnesota again, and Don Mincher joined you, and Felipe Alou.
Felipe Alou had a great life. He used to hit Wilbur Wood, who threw the knuckleball so well.
Yeah.
I asked him one day, I said, Lewis, you know, what kind of adjustments do you make with the knuckleball? Because you hit all the knuckleball pitchers so extremely well. And he says, everybody should hit the knuckleball. You know what's coming. I said, that's not the hard part. The hard part is
where is it going?
Yeah, where is it going so you can hit it? He says, well, there's nothing to it. He says, you know what's coming, so just hit it.
That's a good philosophy if it works. Then in 71, Dick Williams came in as manager. And you guys got serious about things and won the West.
Well, I think the club was serious anyway, but it was... I honestly believe that when you looked at that ball club, even in 67, you could see that it was a club that had great potential.
Yeah.
With a lot of young talent sprinkled in, with some guys that had some experience.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the players, myself included, Sal Bando and a lot of other young pitchers, really got their baptismal, not in the minor leagues for any period of time.
Yeah.
You got it in the major leagues. And I remember joining the ball club when Bando and I drove up all night from Mobile, Alabama. We got into Kansas City at 6:30 in the morning, and we checked into the hotel in Kansas City, and we saw Bobby Hoffman, who at the time was one of the coaches with Kansas City. He says, guys, work out at 10:30 at the ballpark. And we just driven all night. So we got to the ballpark and worked out. And it may have been 2 o'clock workout. So we get to the ballpark and we work out. And we're in the ball game that night.
Gee whiz.
So, you don't have any time to get nervous. You're too tired for it.
Yeah.
But you could see that club was going to win. And when Dick Williams took over...
It was ready.
It was just about there. I mean, the table was pretty well set.
Yeah. Yeah. And they won the West but lost to Baltimore in the playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
They picked up Epstein. Dave Duncan became a regular. And Blue was 24-8. Darryl Knowles made his appearance.
Yeah, Darryl Knowles came over. And then I went to Chicago, and Knowles wound up coming to Chicago, too.
Yeah. Now, I didn't check my trade list, but when you went to Chicago, trade for whom?
Oh, Chicago was Ken Holtzman.
Oh, yeah. Just the two of you, or were there others?
There may have been a couple other people involved.
Well, I'd say that benefited both teams.
Yeah, it did. And quite frankly, I was, even though that I could see that the ball club was going to be winning, I was relieved. I was not disappointed to leave the ball club. I was disappointed to leave some of the friendships that were there and having come up as a youngster for them.
Sure.
But,
that's part of baseball.
I was not, and am still not, a fan of Charlie Finley. And Dick Williams remains at a distance.
As he does with most people.
That's just Dick's way.
And, that's right. You can't change an old-timer like that who's set in a certain way. conditions, circumstances, attitudes, and everything else have passed Dick by now, and he finally, I guess, recognizes it and is in retirement. But...
Yeah, he may have. The other thing that I think really helped me is that Dave Duncan and I, when we were in the Oakland, we were still in Marine Reserve, so every weekend or every month there was a weekend that we would have to fly back from the road, to serve time, and then on a weekend for Marine Corps Reserves, and then at a two-week period during the summer, mm-hmm. we also had to go to summer camp. So there was, there was a five-and-a-half-year period in there that was really cut into a great deal by that.
Okay, so you went over to Chicago and found Leo in charge for the first part of the season, and Whitey Lockman at the end.
Leo the Lip.
He had managed, according to many people, beat him out of a pennant in 69 when they had it all but wrapped up.
You know what's strange? I remember a comment made by Ron Sano, Billy Williams, Joe Pepitone, Glenn Becker, Don Kessinger, mm-hmm. when I joined that ball club. I mean, we were playing in Yuma, Arizona, going down to play the Padres.
Yeah.
And it was in 72, my first year, first spring, and Leo came up and he says, he told the guys who were going to be starting the starting eight, he said, look, he says, you can either play the entire game, and this was early in spring training, where you normally play three or four innings and then go get your running in and extra work, and we're playing Palm Springs the next day. He says, you can either play three innings and get some extra work in, or you can play nine innings if the game goes nine innings, or if the game goes extra innings, you play all 14 or 15 or whatever it is, and I'll fly you guys back to Scottsdale after the game, and you guys can work out there tomorrow, and we'll send one of the coaches back, and you can get some extra work there, or you can play three innings and make the bus trip to Palm Springs.
Mm-hmm.
We said, we'll fly back.
Yeah.
And on the plane, Sano and the guys are saying, now look, don't let this fool you. You'll wonder how anybody in the world could say Leo at times can be difficult to play for because he's flying us all back so we can get our work in. We don't have to make that plane trip. He says, a strange thing will happen. When the bell rings and the season starts, you'll notice Leo, who's been palsy-wowsy with all these umpires, all of a sudden, the tide will change. It goes in, and it did. It did.
You know, by chance, Ted Savage?
Yes.
Who's with the Cardinals now. He played, I don't know if you were there or not. I don't think so.
No,
he played because he was there before you got there. He played for Leo a couple of years, and he talked here to regional meeting. I talked with him and did an article about it for Philly's Report a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. Savage, and he talked to our local media gathering of the Sabre organization, the Society of American Baseball Research, and he got wound up on Leo, and he had the crowd in stitches for half an hour, and his story is for something.
Oh, this is crazy. Are you? One in particular, I mean, Leo had been with so many ball clubs in so many years, day in and day out and year in and year out. But I remember one game we're playing in Chicago and the pitcher spot was due up for us. And I was sitting between Paul Popovich and Jim Hickman. And we were going to have to use a pinch hitter and everybody kind of knew it, but Leo had been involved in an argument with one of the home plate umpires, and I can't recall if it was Shag Crawford or Augie Donatelli, whoever it was.
Mm-hmm.
And so the umpire came over and says, Leo, come on, you're holding the game up. You got to have a pinch hitter. And he goes, Smith, get a bat. Willie, you're the hitter. So Hickman and Popovich and I grabbed towels because we're looking around. Now, Willie Smith has been retired from baseball for about 4 years. And Hickman says underneath his breath, because we're only about 10 feet away from Leo, he says, you watch. I'm going to get blamed for something. And sure enough, the umpire comes over and says, Leo, you're holding the game up. Come on, let's go. Let's get this going. And he goes, I told Willie, get it. Get it back. Cut it. And Hickman says, well, gee, Skip, give us 3 or 4 days and we'll locate him for you. And about that time, The umpire's getting closer, and he's yelling louder at Leo, and he says, I told Hickman to get a bat. Hickman, damn it, get up there and get a hit. And he says, I told you. And I forget who was throwing, but it was some fireballer. So Hickman grabs a bat and grabs a helmet, and he looks back to us with Leo standing right next to him. He says, keep my place warm. I'll be right back.
That's great. Well, when you went over to Chicago, did you notice any particular differences in the two leagues, style of play, style of pitching, umpiring, high and low?
I noticed the difference in all that, because at the time, that's when the American League did not have the option to go to the inner chest protector. Yeah. Everybody used the outer chest protector. And what it did is it kept the American League umpires higher above the catcher.
Yeah.
And it was a higher strike zone. You go to the National League, it was a lower strike zone.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed that speed was a big difference in the National League versus the American League. And the difference that I noticed on the ball clubs, and this is 1972, is that what I observed is that I felt that the National League ball clubs had one or possibly two more players on their ball club, on their 25-man roster, that maybe were just a cut above what the American League might have from a depth standpoint, not from overall talent. But I enjoyed the National League. Maybe it was some of the old rivalries between some of the cities and the teams and what have you, but there seemed to be a little bit more of a spark in the National League. Umpires in the National League seemed to have a great deal of pride in the league that they were a part of. Not saying that the American League did not, but I noticed more of it in the National League.
Do you have the feeling that some people do, that all of the Major League umpires ought to be under the commissioner's office and assigned by them and not regulated by the league presidents?
Until they abolish the designated hitter, hell no. To me, I, as you can probably tell, I am not a believer in the designated hitter. I don't think that adding one more bat in the lineup adds that much more excitement to John Q. Public, who is supporting the game.
Yeah.
To me, I'm a purist, I'll admit it, but I like getting into a situation, say in the sixth, seventh inning, if a guy is throwing a good ball game against your ball club, but it's a tight ball game, and maybe because of an error behind you and you're throwing a good game against us, but now your spot's going to be coming up and we're pitching to that eighth place hitter, and there's a runner at second base and there's nobody out. There's a runner at second base and there's two outs. I like the situation of me, the opposing manager, might walk that eighth place hitter to get to your spot. One, because your pitching is such a tremendous ballgame. What the heck? We can't do any worse if you go to the bullpen.
Yeah.
So now your manager has to make a decision. Do I let my pitcher, who's throwing a very good game, go up and hit for himself and maybe give away a chance to score that run? Or do I go to the bench, pinch hit for him, and come out of the bullpen? To me, there's a lot. To me, that's one of the nice things about the game, is because everyone can come into it immediately. You don't have to second guess. You say, well, I wouldn't have done that. Why don't they pinch hit for him? Why don't they do this, or why don't they do that?
I agree. Yep. All right. Any thoughts about any of your comments, any of your teammates in that first year with the Cubs, after being several years with the A's?
The biggest change was Ernie Banks was a first base coach. You go through the, hotels and airports at 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, flying from this place to this place. And Ernie was always selling. And it didn't matter if there were 4,000 people in the airport or if there were 4 people in the airport, whether 2 o'clock in the afternoon or 2 o'clock in the morning. It was always, yeah, great day to play too. Yeah, we're Chicago Cubs. Yeah, you're here. Yeah, professional ball player. Yeah, ought to pay to play this game.
Nobody could beat him with that.
Nobody could beat him, but everybody brought up that had played with him at about 4 o'clock in the morning after about the 17th. Yeah, great day to play too. they would bring up the situation in Texas before the Astrodome was built, that you know, that was a very hot ballpark down there.
Sure.
And he hit his second triple of the first game of a doubleheader, and as he slid into third base, he passed out. They had to remove him from the ball game. He says, so they put a new meaning to great day to play two.
Was Rick Russell there when you got to Chicago?
I believe so,
yeah. I think he was.
Yeah.
But early in his career.
You know, Rick Russell, a lot of people to this day look at him and say, well, geez, he's out of shape.
Yeah.
He's not.
Then, too.
You know that he has either the lowest percentage of body fat in the San Francisco Giants or is number two.
I think I've read.
And he's a tremendous athlete because during the offseason we had a basketball team that would play charity basketball games or what have you around at different places, different high schools. He is a tremendous basketball player.
I'll be damned.
He's a good golfer, and he's always able to do some things on the baseball field, too.
Hi, Dobber.
What's up, Ricky?
What's up, Gumby?
Yeah, Rick was there that year.
I guess it is, yeah.
You're supposed to go up that much.
Chance of rain or something?
Not anymore, they say.
Mm-hmm.
It'll get a little warmer in the rest of the afternoon, and the wind will die down a little bit. Pretty strong wind right now.
It'll be a little nippy tonight.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, let's see. Move on. 73, Whitey Lockman stayed as your manager, and you came in fifth in the NL East. 74, Lockman was replaced in the season by Marshall, and you finished last in the division. And in 70,
we had some clubs with not a great deal of depth.
Yeah. 75, Marshall was still there, you finished fifth.
Okay, Don.
And Russell came in at 11-17 that season, one of his worst years.
Well, it wasn't so much of one of his worst years. You know, if the club's only winning 20% of its games, it's going to hold true for the starting pitchers are out there. There's one great story is that Russell did such a good job, and Hooten also. You know, Hooten came up and had that knuckle curveball with Chicago and threw the no-hitter his first year he was up.
Right.
But Darryl Knowles, the reliever, came over. One of the years there is that, you know, Knowles at one time, and Pete LeCocq was playing first base. And Knowles had picked off like eight guys during the season. This was towards the end of the season. He picked off like eight runners at first base on a bases loaded, three ball and two strike count, or man at second, first and second, three and two, where LeCocq would sneak in behind him. It had to be before 76, because 76 I played first base. So one afternoon,
Andy Thornton plays in first base.
Yeah. So one afternoon, it's the top of the ninth inning. We're ahead by a run. It's like first and second, or bases loaded, and two outs, and Knowles picks a guy off of first base. The game is over. We're in the locker room, and we're in one of those. We're in one of those cantankerous moods, right, as a ball club, because we're ready to end the season or what have you. And Jerome Holtzman, who was a terrific guy and the dean of all baseball writers, came in, and he asked Knowles, he says, you know, this is the eighth or ninth guy you've picked off this year, you know, without telling me exactly how you're doing it, you know, you obviously have a sign for this. And he goes, well, you'll have to ask Mundy about that. Hi, Bob. And he says, well, why? He says, well, you have to ask him. He said, but you have to promise not to put in what our deals are. So he goes to me, and I'm hearing this, and I see Knowles give me the high sign. So Jerome and I had, you know, we were always kibitzing back and forth. So he says, well, Knowles said I should come over here and talk to you about this pickoff. And you're the one that helps tell him when to put it on. I said, Jerry, I said, you have to promise now that you won't print this, because other ball clubs will be looking for our signs. And he says, what are you talking about? And I said, well, look, I said, what does Knowles do before he pitches a very important ball. You know, before he throws it, what does he do? He says, well, he normally goes back behind the mound and gets a rosin bag. And I said, yeah, where is he looking? And he goes, well, he's looking off into center field. And I said, okay, we've established that point. I said, Jerry, now let's say that you're the center fielder and you're looking in at the play, right? You see second base and the pitcher's mound and home plate all lined up in a row if you're playing straight away. I said, you see third base, you see first base. I said, who besides the center fielder has a better shot as to how much daylight that there is between the runner at first and the first baseman in the bag? I said, I do. So when Knowles is ready to go, he looks to me in center field and I let him know if there's a lot of daylight. And then he flashes a sign to Lecoq. I said, but you can't print this. You know, there's no way you can print this. Next morning, the paper is put in there that Knowles looks to center field and he comes in and we can't believe it. We're laughing. We're laughing and laughing. And then the game's over, in walks Jerome Holzwinkel. And he's very upset. And he says, why in the hell would you tell me this? And I said, Jerry, I said, you know, you're affectionately called the Dean